I get over here. This is one of the first times that I've consented to come to a college campus to speak. I think, indeed, this is the first time I've consented to come to a college campus to speak, because in the first place, I do not think of myself as a great stirring speaker, and I never have any intent to stir people, to excite them emotionally about anything that has no pragmatic results. And because I still do not view myself, very frankly, as what you would call a national leader, I have no aspirations in that direction at all. My work is what I use to preach my sermons. My work is what I use to make my speeches. Any man or woman might be trained to be eloquent, but it is not what you say, but it is what you do. And too long, we've had emotionalization without too much pragmatic result. And it is my view that the time has come for Afros particularly to do less talking and more doing, and to realize that this white man is no longer afraid of black people's noise, because he's learned if you make noise, if he wants to, he can shoot you and nobody will say anything about it. The day when we could use our feet to make our protest is gone. The day has come when black men must use their brains and prove to white men that they're not super, and prove to white people all around this world that what a white man can do, a black man can do just as well and sometimes better. So I'm not here to make any impression on you, any of you, black or white, because I make my own decisions, I stand on my own two big feet, and I say what I think. I do not see myself as a national leader. Let's get that straight. It doesn't matter to me if my name never appears in the Look magazine or the Life magazine, because my thing is going to keep on doing when I'm gone. There's a new movement that is emerging in America. A whole new kind of movement. Some people call it evangelical materialism. Some people are beginning to call it a new pragmatic gospel. Whatever people call it, there is a new movement emerging in America, different from anything America has ever seen, and it's emerging quietly. It's not emerging loudly. It's emerging quietly, and it is taking roots little by little all across this land. The decade of the 50s, and I'm not going to use my written speech. The decade of the 50s was an exciting new decade for America. Up to that time, we lived indeed in two Americas. We lived in black America and we lived in white America. I know, because I was born in black America. I was born in a dirt alley, in a little town in West Virginia. When I went to school where I was born, I went to school on the black side of the street. The white boys and girls went to school on the white side of the street. The only time we met was on Halloween night, midnight, when we met in the middle of the main street and had a great big fight. And then we kept on walking the rest of the year on either side of the street. I did not know a white boy or girl by the first name until I was 21 years of age. All I knew was my black America, my black world, my black alley. But all while that was going on, something was happening to me. It was happening to thousands of black men and women, boys and girls across America. For a new black American was emerging on the scene. And he had determined in his mind that either America was going to be America for everybody or America was going to be America for nobody. The great movement that we've read so much of in this last decade did not start just with the last decade. This movement has moved cybernetically over the last years into what it has become. For men and women learn that black man was not inferior to white man, and that black man no longer had to be afraid of white man. And it began to emerge in the 30s and in the 40s, when hundreds of black men and women suffered genocide in this country at the hand of lynchers, at the hands of Ku Klux Klanners, at the hands of whites who had no intention of seeing that doors would be opened in full opportunity to black men or women. It was during that day that a new emergence of freedom became to be a part of the American scene. And this new black man began to emerge. He was a black man who lost his fear. He was a black man who was embodied in that young black fellow who opened a store one day in the West Virginia hills, where there was segregation and discrimination then, and where white people did not want black people to make advancement. And he called his place, because he sold pig feet, Piggly Wiggly. And this black cat sold so many pig feet, but the white folks decided that he was making too much money. They decided they'd better frighten him away, just like they had frightened black people away for all the years before, because all they had to do was to frighten a black man and he would run. So they came to Joe, to Piggly Wiggly, and they tried to frighten him. And they said, "Joe, either by tomorrow morning Piggly Wiggly is going to have to go, or you're going to have to go." So Joe went back home and prayed about it. He was this new black man that was emerging on the scene that the white folks weren't used to dealing with. And they went back the next morning, and there was old black Joe standing in the door of the store. And the white folks came back and said, "Joe, we thought we told you that by this morning Piggly Wiggly had to go or you had to go." And Joe said, "Look up, white folks. No longer Piggly Wiggly, it's Hoggly Wobbly now." New black man began to emerge on the American scene in the 30s and the 40s. And it was he who began to open the eyes of America. He began to open the eyes of black America and white America to a realization that a new nation was being born, that the old America was in labor and a new America was being born. Then came the decade of the 50s. The decade of the 50s was a decade of litigation. Up to that time, the books that carried the laws of the nation justified segregation of black people against white people. The laws on the books of America legalized segregation and discrimination. The laws on the books of America said that it was legal
that schools could be segregated and peoples could be separated and communities could be segregated and separated. It was legal, it was law, and therefore the decade of the 50s was a decade of litigation in which great giants, the names of whom many of you perhaps have forgotten, like Attorney Houston and Thurgood Marshall and many others who now are gone, fought before the bars of justice of America to see that those old laws were changed and new laws were put in their places. In the year 1954, that great decision of the Supreme Court came forth to stir the nation to the effect that separate but equal facilities of public education in America were no longer legal or constitutional, because something separate but called the name of equal was still inherently within a democracy inferior. Ripples began to flow from Washington as a result of that decision that became waves and then became tides. It took no more than a decision to begin to move in the arena of litigation, because 100 and 1,000 communities said, in spite of what the Supreme Court said, we still say that it's illegal for blacks and whites to go to the same schools together, and we will hold the line. And in 1,000 courtrooms across America, lawyers whose names are extinct in history stood to argue the case of the equality of black men and women in an American so-called democratic society. The years of the 50s were the years of litigation. It was the decade of tearing the walls of legalistic discrimination down to the ground. The decade of the 50s was the decade of American litigation for the freedom of black people in this nation. The decade of the 60s emerged as the logical consequence of the 50s, an extension of the result of the activities of the litigation. And it became the decade of demonstrations and protest. For even when the laws were put on the books, even when they were changed in word, in fact and indeed, the door still remained closed. And there emerged on the scene such great lights that will continue to illuminate the history of the nation and one day the history of the world. Men like the incomparable Dr. Martin Luther King, other great men like Malcolm and others whom I knew so very well, who stirred the American black community into a realization that you get nothing by sitting back and waiting for white folks to do it for you. You gotta get on the streets and get it yourself. Doggone. Well, that emerged in the 60s. You never heard anything like this. Didn't expect anything like this from Joe Moore. I emerged in the 60s, the decade of protest and demonstration, in which there were those of us who said that we will not be silent, we shall not be still, until opportunity and freedom comes to every child, black or brown or yellow, across the face of this nation. And so we marched, and we marched, and we cried aloud. We did things the nation had never seen before. Many of us died along the way. Many who were dear, dear friends of mine, whom I'll never see again on this side of the earth, whose names some of you will never know, who gave their lives in the mountains and the hills and the rocks of America so that we might have a taste of freedom. It was a decade of demonstrations and protests. And the doors began to open and people began to realize a new black man had emerged on the American scene. That decade is over. The past always is prologue. There is no yesterday, there is only tomorrow. And those who strive to live in yesterday just for yesterday's sake shall never see the beauty and the brilliance of tomorrow. Time moves on. The inexorable clock ticks. talks day by day until every generation is called upon in its own way to shoulder its own burden and to do its own thing. And today we're in a new decade. It is the decade of black progress. It has emerged so silently upon you that many of you in your colleges and universities do not even realize what has happened. Many of you still characterize what is happening in the black communities by the books you read, without realizing the guys that wrote that book don't even know what the cats are doing back there in the community. You have become so isolated, many of you, in your enclaves, in your white sepulchred college communities, that you don't know what's going on. Preach that stuff, Sullivan. Many of your professors are so stilted with their philosophizing and their theorizing and their scrutinizing. Watch out, Sullivan, that you don't know what's going on in the community of America today. But there's a new, great, wonderful movement emerging. It is not a movement of moderation. It is not a movement of conservatism, as some may look at it and read lightly and say, that is what is happening now. It is a movement far more militant than anything that has happened before. For those of us who are involved in the new movement, we'll never go back. We shall never go backwards. We shall always only go forward until every black child is free in this country. Then the movement unveiled and developed a whole new way. The white folks have learned how to deal with us in the other kind of movement. They got smart. I didn't know white folks had the sense they had until just a few years ago. They decided the way to do it is to use what the God is the chief instrument in a democracy, and that is to use the courts and the law. And they've learned out how to choke off your leaders and those persons who are leading you forward. They do it now. They don't need billy clubs. They do it with the law. They do it with a new kind of law. They do it with their court systems. And they take you when you get out of line and they put you in jail. And then they fix it up so that when they let you out, you're on bail or parole. They fix you up and tie you up so that your leaders are so tied up that they're afraid to do anything. And they fix it up so that not only are the white folks in favor of keeping you in jail, they even got black folks in favor of keeping you in jail. They've decided how to do it with a new technique. They've decided how to do it with their courts and their law. They're not afraid of your marching anymore. Because they know when you start marching, when you leave out of the black community, there are going to be some tanks there to stop you. And they're not worried even about shooting some of you. Because they know that if they shoot you and they leave you laying dead in the streets, they can fix it with their publicity in such a way that even the black folks would say it was just as well you got shot. Got another way of doing it. I didn't know he had the sense that he had. Therefore, you have to move in another way. If you want truly to be equality, you have to do it more not with your feet now, but you're going to have to do it with your head. You're going to have to do it with your head, and you're going to have to do it with your hands, and you're going to have to do it with your money. Now, that's why OIC came about. You see OIC in Champaign, you say, well, my gracious, it's just a school. OIC is a result, a spin-out of a need for America, of dealing with a problem in a pragmatic way that could ensure advancement, not because I'm against violence. I'm not philosophically against violence. I'm no more philosophically against violence than Moses was against it, or that George Washington was against it, or that Patrick Henry was against it. I'm not philosophically against violence. If I thought violence could free my people, I'd get guns and start shooting. I'm a black guy who's not for nonviolence, period. Get that straight. Get that straight.
If a man hits me, brother, I'm going to hit him back.
Get that straight.
Get that straight. I'm a preacher. Two.
Let's get that straight.
If I thought it was possible for black people and the poor and the minorities of America to get their freedom by revolution, I would get in front of them.
I'm not against violence philosophically. I'm against violence practically and strategically. Because I've seen too many of my black brothers lying in the streets with guns in their hands dead because they were blasted away and nobody could do anything to help them. I'm against violence strategically and practically because I can't win my freedom in America or in the world with guns. I don't own a single gun factory. I can't do like Moses did. And I can't do like Joshua did. Watch out, son. Therefore, to be free, I have to do it strategically. And I have to do it practically. And I have to use my head. And I have to use my hands. I've got to outthink you. OIC has merged. In the forefront of this new little movement, to help people first to get the attitude of their own sense of appreciation and to realize what they can do if they get together and strive to help themselves. Couldn't do it with guns, couldn't do it with arms. I had to do it by first developing the brain power and the skill power of people so they can compete in a world such as this, where 99% of my people have been relegated to service occupations and where more and more of my people had to depend upon the government for their survival. It was in the latter part of the 1950s that I saw the need for this kind of approach. In 1958, in the city of Philadelphia, there were no black people driving a single oil truck in Philadelphia. There were no black people driving a single newspaper truck in Philadelphia. There were no black people as a secretary in a single oil company of Philadelphia. There were no black people doing anything of any consequence in the city of Philadelphia, the place of brotherly love. They had commissions on human relations all over the place. They had these outfits that were trying to say that they were doing something to let us in, but all those cats were doing sitting around them big desks and smoking them big cigars, and I'm still in trouble, no jobs. So I decided that I wouldn't depend on the mayor of the city, nor the governor of the state, nor the president of the United States to change the system that discriminated against my people. And so I prayed about it. I prayed about that. Ask God to show us what to do. We organized 400 black preachers in the city of Philadelphia. And we decided we wouldn't ask anymore any mayor, any governor to open doors for us that were closed, but that the children of God who believed that God had all power in his hands would pragmatize the gospel and prove what people could do when they did it together. And we went to a company that was one of the great invokers of discrimination in the city of Philadelphia called Tasty Cake. You never heard of Tasty Cake out here. Tasty Cake Bakery is the biggest maker of cakes in the city of Philadelphia. They make the best cakes in town, too. But their problem was that they didn't employ any black men driving them trucks, and they didn't employ any black girls in those offices. The only jobs they had were those black women sweeping and mopping up them cake floors. And I decided we would start right there with Tasty Cake. So I went to see Mr. Tasty Cake. And I said, Mr. Tasty Cake, I said, now, Mr. Tasty Cake, all we want is just a few black folks driving some of your trucks, a couple of black girls in your offices, and the assurance that you would keep, I don't need no water, man, just leave me alone. In your offices, and if you do that, Mr. Tasty Cake, everything will be all right. We buy your cakes, Mr. Tasty Cake. Mr. Taster Cake said, I'm gonna think about it. He said, you know, we're not quite ready for that kind of thing. It might create problems. We said, Mr. Taster Cake, you got 2 weeks to think about it. 2 weeks we went later, and Mr. Taster Cake was still thinking about it. The next Sunday morning, 400 black preachers went to our pulpits, and when we finished talking about Jesus, we talked about Taster Cake. Black folks stopped eating that Taster Cake. Them Taster Cake chunks came in with them white cats selling them, and nobody would buy them. That Mr. Taster Cake decided he would fly out of town. He knew the black folks would be divided in a few weeks. He went out of town and stayed 3 months until the treasurer called and said, Mr. Taster Cake, if you want to plant, you better come back town now. He came back and called me. He said, Reverend Sullivan, please tell them black folks to eat Taster Cake again. And the next morning, some black men begin to drive some of them Taster Cake trucks, and some good-looking brown-skinned girls begin to type on some of them green typewriters. First time in America. It was the first time. It was the first time in America that selective patronage had been invoked against a single company, concentrating the purchasing power of our community against a single company. After we left Taster Cake and all the other bread companies got in line, we decided we'd go to the soft drink industry. And I remember I went to see Mr. Coca-Cola. Mr. Coca-Cola didn't have any black salesmen driving. Mr. Coca-Cola didn't have any black girls. So I went there and with the other guys with me, and Mr. Coca-Cola evidently hadn't heard of Mr. Taster Cake. So he said it would create too many problems. They didn't have the jobs available. We said, you got 2 weeks to find them. We went back and he still hadn't found them, and the next Sunday morning, 400 of us, after he finished talking about Jesus, we talked about Coca-Cola. And lo and behold, Mr. Coca-Cola didn't know that black folks drink all that Coca-Cola. He didn't know that colored folks, black folks, drink Coca-Cola for breakfast, noon, and dinner. And he didn't know that we're so poor that some of us even use them for chasers. It didn't take long with Mr. Coca-Cola. As a matter of fact, before the week was over, he sent me a telegram, that's it. Tell me, Rev, just send me somebody. We got some jobs for him to do. And we went through Philadelphia for 4 years. Through the soft drink industry, through the supermarket industry, through the newspaper industry. The first blacks to be on television were in Philadelphia because I said to the television industry, if you don't hire us, we'll turn off our doggone television sets. We won't even look at your station. Watch out, Sullivan. When we opened jobs by the thousands in the city of Philadelphia, we opened them by the thousands. Then, protest must always be accompanied with progress. For to protest and to have no progress is an illusion to opportunity. Therefore, as the jobs became available, I looked around to find my people to fill the jobs. They were jobs my people never had the opportunity to fill before. We were never trained for the kind of jobs coming about. IBM keeper jobs, teletype jobs, machinist jobs, electronic computer jobs. These jobs we never had the opportunity to have before. And although now I had jobs by the thousands, I could not find my people skilled to fill the jobs. And I found that integration without preparation was frustration. And that in addition to integration, to which I must continue to labor until I die, that I must also put my efforts towards preparation, that I must help my men and my women to be prepared, that they might take these jobs, that they might secure the kind of money that others had gotten all their lives, that they might be able to stand upon their own feet. There were no training programs in America doing this kind of thing. All the other training programs in America screened my people out. And we needed a program to screen my people in. We had no money. And so I went to my church and asked my church to help me, and my church loaned me $40,000. And I got a mortgage on my house. And I went street by street with 100 women, and I raised $100,000 to start OIC. We got all machines that plants had thrown aside, put into a basement to try to train men to be machinists, to be millers, and to be lathe operators. I didn't even know at that time in 1963 anything about electronic assembly or electronic stuff. Our people now didn't have the opportunity to do that kind of thing. Very few of us in America were in the electronics industry. I didn't even know what an electronic console was. As a matter of fact, when I opened the first OIC in an old abandoned jailhouse that I got for $1 a year from the city, in order to try to let my people know that we were going to do something that was exciting and technical, I got an old radio and cut the radio down in pieces, slices. And because I had to show them we were going into electronics, it was January when I opened the center, and I had some blinking Christmas light bulbs. And I got the blinking Christmas light bulbs and put them behind an improvised old radio console and turned them on. So if people came by, the lights were blinking, and I said, that's an electronic console. That's what happened in that old jailhouse. Some of you were there in 1963. Because black people never had the opportunity to even understand what electronics was all about. We had been shut out of it. But OIC caught on. Because it was designed to help the people. It wasn't a government program. It was a people's program. And it was a program that said to people, you must put something into it in order to get something out of it. I didn't only just want to train a man in a skill, though. Because black people had to get our minds straightened out. We had to get our unwashed brains unwashed. For 100 years, black people had been taught they were inferior to white people. And I had to teach black people that they were as good and could be as great and as abilitated as anybody that walked the face of the earth. And so I created what I call the feeder program. The feeder program is one in which every person comes first. Where they get their attitudes straightened out, where they get their minds straightened out, where they realize that all that junk they had heard about black inferiority was a great big myth, where we taught people to put their heads up and their shoulders back, where we taught black women they didn't have to be blonde to be beautiful, black men they didn't have to be white to be smart. We taught them to get rid of all that junk they had in their minds, of black being worse than white, because my people had been taught it was true all our lives. We've been taught it in the books we read, in the radio shows we heard, in the television shows we heard. We've been taught that white was better than black. We'd even been taught it in the food we ate. When cake was white, it was angel food, and when it was black, it was devil food. We've been taught it in everything. We had to unwash our brainwashed minds, and it was I. In 1963, developed a massive program of heritage education and self-black pride so that black men and women could have a sense of regard and appreciation for what they were, because I wanted black men and women to know what anyone else had done they could do too. I wanted our people to be like one of those two black boys who seeing an airplane fly overhead. One said, oh, I wish I was white so I could fly that plane like that white boy. And the other little one said, if that white boy give me the throttle, I'll fly it as black as I am. I wanted you to know that you can fly as black as you are. And OIC began to work, began to train hundreds, and then thousands, and then tens of thousands. Until today, OIC is in 105 cities in this country, training 20,000 people a day. It is now in Nigeria, it is in Ghana, it is in Kenya, it is in Ethiopia, it is in British Honduras, it is in Belize. It is all around the world. Today, in 8 years, 4,000 black people get salaries every 2 weeks working with OIC. We employ more black administrators than any 5 programs in this country.
Even now, cities steal our administrators for assistance to mayors, treasurers to treasurer offices, financial experts, supervisors, trainers, 4,000 black men and women who every 2 weeks are employed by OIC helping their brothers to help themselves. It is the new industry of opportunity for black people in America, where they can help themselves to help their brothers. And it's only the beginning. We're in 100 cities now. Next year we'll be in 125. 1975 we'll be in 300. And by 1976, when they toot that horn about the Declaration of Independence, OIC is going to be in every black and red and yellow community in America. Give it a hand. We're on our way. Watch out for it. Just watch for it. You may never hear from me again because I don't like to come to your campuses. Yes, I said I don't like to come to your campuses. I don't like to come to your campuses because so many of you are detached from reality. You left your communities and got up in these great big institutions and forgot where you came from. You're detached from reality. I don't have to come here. Oh, praise God. Gotten in your white sepulchres. Some of you white folks are as bad as your parents are, as far as hypocrisy is concerned. Many of you try to act liberal, but you just act like a bigot, some of you. Oh, I know you got some administrators here, and nobody's going to invite me to another campus. Anyway, and some of you black kids who talk so much about your militants and talk so much about helping your brothers and so great about all that black power stuff, you've gotten up here, forgotten where you come from, and you've gotten into that middle class bag, and you're no good to anybody. Why I don't like to come here. I'd rather go down where I belong. I belong in Watts, that's where I walk the streets. I belong in Columbia, that's where I walk the streets. I'm not interested in your television shows and your radios and your college campuses. The little thing you give me, I'm gonna give it right back to my program. I don't take any money for this junk. Coming here to see you. My church pays me, it's all the pay I want. I wanna be paid by my own people so I can tell you what I think, and doggone whether you like it or not. Get you straight and get your heads and your hearts in order. OIC is here, and we're not going to fade away. We're going to be here helping our brothers and our sisters. And we're going to help all of them. We're going to even help white folks. So that across America now, even in white Appalachia, they're organizing OICs because we're not going to do to others what they did to us. It's an American thing. But now I'm going to tell you a secret as I come in. OIC is only what you see. There's something else that's coming under it. If you think I'm just getting folks together to get them a job, you better think again. I'm in it so that my people can get some money. So they can get some jobs leading someplace. So they can buy some houses of their own, educate their children, and get some money in the bank and stand on their own feet. I'm in it to help people get some money, but not just for themselves, but so that they can help their brothers. If what I do, I have done just to help people for themselves, I have failed. For I'm not interested in helping even black people just for their individual selves. I did not create OIC just for 4,000 people to get salaries working in OIC. I didn't do it for that. I did it so that black men and women could get something in their hands so they could begin to share it to help their brother. Because as long as you're just concerned about your own little self, you shall all die. And I want black men and women to be concerned.
concerned about their brothers.
I don't want us to get in that corporate bag where everybody's concerned about getting rich himself and to heck with everybody else. I want you to get something, but I want you to share it with your fellow man. And when you get to the place where you're willing to share with your fellow man, you'd be surprised what you can do. This is the pragmatic gospel. It is what Jesus talked about. When Jesus said to the little boy in the assembly, 5,000 of them, he said, "Is there food to eat?" And everybody was silent but a little boy who had a basket, and he said, "Take the basket with my loaves and fishes." And the miracle was not in the boy's giving, but the miracle was in the 5,000 sharing. Because a boy gave and inspired 5,000 to share. And when they shared, there was food enough for all to eat and 12 baskets left over. So I decided I would pragmatize the gospel. When I went to my church and asked my church for people who were willing to put $10 down for 36 months in what I call a 1036 plan. And I said to them, "You won't benefit from this maybe in your lifetime. But you put $10 down for 36 months, and we will build new institutions for your city, and we'll provide help for your children when you're dead in the grave for your children and your children's children. But give now so that you can share with your children. You may not benefit from it, but your children will." And 200 members of my church began that Sunday morning to put $10 down for 36 months. At the end of 1 year, we had accumulated enough money to build a $1 million apartment complex. It was the first apartment in the whole city of Philadelphia where black plumbers and black bricklayers and black builders built it themselves. At the end of the second year, I had 600 people. And we had gathered enough money, $10 a month for 36 months, that I remember one couple in my church went to rent an apartment in an all-white apartment house. They were refused because they were black. They came back and told me, and the next week we bought the apartment house. We continued to put our $10 together. And I decided I was going to build a shopping center. I was going to build a shopping center comparable to any center built by white people in any place in my section of America, any place in the country. And I remember I went to see a bank president. I tried to get a conventional mortgage because I didn't need any government money. Didn't need any government money. And I went to the bank and I said to the president, and he was sitting there, I remember he had his glasses on one side of the desk, and I sitting on the other side, and he had his arms folded. And I said, "Mr. President," I said, "I'd like to just have a conventional loan that you loan to anybody going into business, and I want to build a shopping center." And he said, "Oh, Reverend Solomon." He said, "You want to build a shopping center?" He said, "How much is it going to cost?" I said, "About $2 million. He said, "Reverend Solomon." He said, "$2 million means you've got to have some equities. Now, we can't give you any gifts. Now, what do you have for equities?" I had a fellow by the name of Elmer Young. And Elmer's with me. I said, "Elmer, open the bag." Elmer had an old bag, zipper broken on it. And Elmer stood up and opened that bag, and $200,000 fell out on the table. That man's glasses fell off the back. He walked around the table, came and took my hand and said, "Mr. Solomon, we can work together. If you want to get a white man, call your mister, get some money." Oh, 600 people did it. $10 down for 36 months. We now own $6 million worth of stuff. 5,000 people in Philadelphia now put $10 down every month. 5,000 of us. We have opened two factories. We have opened an aerospace company. We didn't need money from anybody but just conventional banks. The General Electric Company gave us the expertise we needed because I didn't know anything about aerospace. I just said if they're going to go into air, they ought to have some integrated angels flying up there. So I decided to go up there, I'm going to be there with you. And we opened an aerospace company. It is the largest aerospace company in the world, owned by black folks. And we built it with trainees out of OIC. Managers have been trained out of OICs and in our churches. We now have $6 million worth of contracts. And I'll tell you this, if anybody thinks they're going to Mars anymore without black folks being there, watch out, because I can get there too. You don't have the brains locked up anymore. You don't have them locked up anymore. And we're just starting. This is stuff you're not hearing on your college campus. As a matter of fact, there's some folks who might not even want you to know it. But it's a new movement. And I'll tell you this. There are 105 cities where there are OICs. There are 1 million constituents in the OIC movement. There are 5,000 preachers tied into the OIC complex across this nation. In Nigeria, the leader of OIC is the leading Muslim layman of Nigeria. In Ghana, the leader of the biggest tribe in all Nigeria. In Kenya, the Kenyattas and the Tamimbayas, whose dead and his tribe still lives on, are those who are developing OICs. Last month, I talked to Emperor Haile Selassie. And we have lands by the thousands of acres. If you think we're going to stay under your heel anymore, you think again, we are on our way. Glory, hallelujah! A new movement! Watch it! Hallelujah! I may never come back here, but I told you why. Don't honor it. I'm just testing something today to see how it works. Just testing. First time I've ever done it. Just testing. I'm using you as a guinea pig. Just testing. But we're no longer afraid. No longer will we say, or nor let you say, that you can do what we cannot do. No longer even will we be divided. For years they divided us. But they shall not divide us any longer. And we shall use our black power. But black power without green power and brain power isn't any power now. So, we will say black power, and we shall combine it with our brain power and our green power. And the day shall come, like from a little wave into a great tide, the movement of self-help among the poor, black, brown, and red, and whites who believe as we do, shall spread across this nation. There shall be a new kind of economics, a new kind of economics of real freedom for everyone. We shall not wait on someone to tell us how. We shall do it ourselves. And by the grace of God, we shall change the cries in our streets from our brothers who have no other way to exert what they feel except by it. We shall change the cries from burn, baby, burn to a new cry. A cry of build, brother, build. Right on!
Now, there will be a reception also following the question and answer period at ISR in the multipurpose room, which is on the lower level in ISR. That will go on to about approximately 9:30, quarter to 10. So Reverend Sullivan now will entertain some questions from you.